For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we'll be taking a look at some of the books shortlisted for this year's Yoto Carnegie Medal. Julian Sedgwick blends prose and manga to revisit the aftermath of the Fukushima catastrophe. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock tackles teen issues in her series of short stories, Everyone Dies Famous in a Small Town. And Manjeet Mann explores the things we have in common, no matter where we come from, in her verse novel, The Crossing. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest prize, recognising outstanding works of children's literature. And the list of former winners includes many of the best-loved children's authors of all time. This year, the award has a new sponsor, Yoto, whose products bring the joy of audiobooks to even the youngest readers. Six of this year's eight shortlisted books are based on real-world events, with many of them demonstrating the power of friendship in helping young people overcome challenges and celebrate difference. The result will be announced on the 16th of June, and before that, Read On will be focusing on the books in contention. So, first up, Julian Sedgwick is the author of six books for children, and co-author with his brother Marcus of the illustrated novel Voyages in the Underworld of Orpheus Black, which was shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal in 2020. His latest book, Tsunami Girl, is the product of his lifelong love of Japanese culture. Part prose, part manga, it's a coming-of-age novel set during the 2011 Great Eastern Japan earthquake and the subsequent Fukushima disaster. Julian joined me from his home in Ely, near Cambridge, to tell me more. Julian, welcome to Read On, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Yoto Carnegie Medal.
Thank you very much. It's a real delight to be talking about the book with you, and it is a real delight, obviously, to be shortlisted. I was shortlisted 2 years ago with my brother, but of course everything went a bit strange and a lot of the follow-up activities never happened, so I feel very lucky to be back again.
I know you love making in-person appearances, especially at schools, and literacy is very much at the heart of what you do. You're passionate about making books accessible to children of all ages, aren't you?
Yeah, I think like many perhaps slightly anxious and sensitive children, you know, books were a huge escape for me when I was going through quite a traumatic school experience when I was growing up. And, you know, perhaps we'll talk about that a bit later, about books that helped me along the way. So when I'm doing school visits, I'm hoping I'm talking to everyone, but particularly reaching out to people who might be using reading to get through something in their life.
Tsunami Girl tells the story of a British schoolgirl who gets caught up in the Fukushima catastrophe. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit more about her and about the events of the 2011 earthquake and its aftermath?
So I've had a lifelong interest in Japan and some very important relationships, friendships, particularly with a kind of Japanese quasi-father I had. So I was very tied into the culture and the people when the Great East Japan earthquake disaster happened. And I was glued to the television. And for some people, this was, you know, a triple disaster. So first of all, the biggest earthquake ever to hit Japan. Secondly, a tsunami that destroyed towns and villages up and down the northeast coast, sadly killing 20,000 people that day. An almost unimaginable event. And some of the images were surreal. And already I was thinking, how do you start to cope with something like that? How do you start to rebuild your life if almost your entire town has been destroyed? And then for the community of Fukushima and many of the communities there, they had to cope with a radiation disaster when the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant suffered three meltdowns. And of course, this has only ever happened once before at Chernobyl, just over, 36 years ago now. And all of these things came together. And for a long time, I thought, well, I don't know if I can tell a story about this. But I had friends living in Fukushima City, and I was talking to them almost every day. And slowly, the idea of this character who was partly an outsider, partly someone with one foot in that part of Japan, travelling into the disaster area, and how that person would deal with the problems. And Yuki is only a quarter Japanese. She has one Japanese grandparent, a grandfather she loves dearly, and she has arrived on the Japanese coast, unfortunately, the day before the disaster strikes. So the book is about how she copes and what happens to her and her grandfather.
I believe that you were dealing with your own grief at the time of the catastrophe, which gave you, I suppose, not just an insight, but an even greater empathy with what was going on out there.
Yeah, it was. My dad had meant a lot to me. He died when I was a student at university, and that had been quite a shock to me. It was unexpected. But I'd made this friend, an older Japanese academic and writer, who became a kind of second father to me. And he became very much a grandfather to my two little boys when they were born. And we were lucky we got to travel in Japan with him and go to some amazing places. And he bought a house in our village when he retired. And then he unexpectedly died. And we were all kind of processing that loss, I think, when the tsunami struck. And somehow it kind of all got mixed up in my head. And it was only after I'd finished writing the book, I realized that was one of the big triggers for writing the book. I think that's often the way the motivations and the triggers only become clear when you're finishing a book, or even when you finished it.
Clearly, it was very important to you to be sensitive to the feelings of those who had been directly affected out in Japan. And I know that your research took you out there. Can you describe some of the research that you did both in the UK and then in the affected zone around Fukushima?
Yeah, I knew I'd have to travel there. I mean, some books, it's amazing what you can do via libraries, YouTube, audio interviews, whatever. But I had no idea what it felt like to have experienced a disaster like this. And I had no idea what it felt like to stand in that empty zone, the so-called evacuation zone or exclusion zone. So in 2018, which is already then 7 years after the disaster, I traveled to Fukushima and got permission to go inside the radiation evacuation zone with a guide. And also then talking to lots of residents in the towns and villages around the edge of the zone. And the following year, I went back again. I took my now grown up boys with me because I wanted them to meet the extraordinarily inspiring people I'd met there. I'd expected to find trauma, and I'd expected to find sadness and loss. And that was there for sure, definitely. But also there's this amazing sense of hope and optimism about trying to rebuild something. And it's really difficult, but they are slowly rebuilding lives in those communities. So, yes, it was very moving, very inspiring, and a little bit unexpected what I found there.
The scale of the disaster is almost unimaginable. You must have found it quite overwhelming. I know you've worked as a therapist, but how did you find the people over there and also their reaction to the project that you were looking to undertake? Almost on their behalves, I suppose.
Yeah, I wanted to tread very carefully, very lightly, because I didn't want to come in saying, oh, I'm going to write this amazing story, aren't you lucky, or something like that. It was very much about sounding out what people felt about me doing this as an outsider. But I found just support really from everyone. The main concern a lot of the people, particularly on the north side of the exclusion zone, have is that their stories are being forgotten, even in wider Japan, in Tokyo, say, and certainly abroad. All news becomes old news, and then it's pushed out by other news stories, isn't it? So they were very encouraging, and that kind of made me feel that I had a green light to try, at least. And then I made sure I had sensitivity readers, Japanese sensitivity readers, in particularly one young female academic who had worked after the disaster doing listening therapy with survivors. So I was trying to take all these safeguards. As for my own reaction, yeah, just the scale. When you drive north from the community I know quite well now in Fukushima, when you drive north towards Sendai and you just see the vast area that is now marked as the tsunami inundation zone, it takes your breath away. And when you look at I think it was almost more looking at a lot of videos when I was doing research back at home, just looking at entire towns and communities being wiped away by this wall of water and thinking about how you start to piece your life back together again after that. It was mind-blowingly difficult to comprehend.
Now, whilst obviously it was a tragedy that was reported globally, it was something that the Japanese diaspora across the world felt particularly keenly. And I know that the manga artist Chia Katsuwada, who has illustrated Tsunami Girl, has spoken of her own sense of grief and loss. Did she have reservations, and did you have frank discussions with her before starting?
Yeah, we did. I was introduced to Chia by a mutual friend, another manga artist who lives quite close to where I live. So I wrote an email saying, hi, this is who I am, this is what I'm trying to do. And I know Chia's reaction first was, who's this white guy who thinks he's going to write about the disaster? We do events together now, and she speaks really movingly about how she was affected by the disaster, even though she was living here in the UK. And I think that happens a lot to expats when something happens tragically back at home. The effect can be as big, if not bigger, because you feel helpless. You feel so far away from being able to check in on loved ones or even volunteer. So we had a few Zoom conversations and phone calls. And, well, Chia says, let me put it this way, Chia says pretty quickly she felt she could trust me and that I was doing all the things I could do to be sensitive and thoughtful. And ultimately, we're now working on another book together. So hopefully that's an indication that we found a way of working together. But I think she also found it, by her own account, a therapeutic experience to work on the book. She had avoided looking at news stories and videos and articles for years about the disaster. It tended to produce a kind of depression in her. So she had some hesitation, yes, about working on the book, but we got there and I think she's glad she did it.
Can you describe the additional dimension that manga brings to this story?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember now why I wanted to do a combined prose and manga book. I think it was partly because I'd seen my younger son in particular develop this affection for manga as he was growing up. And also for Japanese culture and publishing, it's something like 40% of everything that is published is in manga format. And if you look back in history in Japan, you always see this combination of words and images working together. And it took me a long time to work out how the manga and the prose were going to work together and hopefully enhance each other. And it was only when I realized that the manga could tell us about the world that is harder to access, shall we put it that way? So the sort of borderline between this world, which in Japan is called Konoyo, and Anoyo, which is that world, the other world, the world of the spirits. And so I thought this would give us a chance to see both of the worlds in different ways. And also, when you're telling a sort of two-voice story, it's quite nice to have definition between the two parts. Sometimes people use different text fonts or something like that, but this gives us a clear division between the two narrative voices.
It occupies that kind of liminal zone that we, I suppose, see in art, such as by William Blake or Richard Dadd, where spirits step into our world, but just in the corner of our eyes.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Blake, lifelong passion of mine and of my dad as well. And he, of course, always used images slipped in with text wrapped around them, often to try and show something about that liminal world, as you say. And Japan, it's very interesting. I talk a lot with Chia about this and with my Japanese teacher about how much that liminal space is maybe a little bit bigger in Japan. And I think certainly after the disaster, that space opened up. So you get so many ghost stories, strange things happening after disaster. So it seemed a way to work with that.
I was wondering how this might be turned into an audiobook, because obviously manga is such a visual medium. But I understand that there is an audiobook version on the way.
Yes, I think there is. Let me put that caveat. Certainly, my publisher, Guppy Books, are in talks with someone about doing this. And of course, there is a slight question about how you are going to get the manga to work. When I write manga, I write it in screenplay format. So I worked on the edge of the film and TV world for a bit and helped develop scripts and screenplays. And what I realized was actually the best screenplays do read as bits of literature, because you have to tell things in incredibly precise way with a minimum of verbiage. So what I think will work is sort of reading the script, and then we'll probably put in a few sound effects, that kind of thing as well, and hopefully that will conjure the manga sections up.
And while that is still in the planning stage, you very kindly agreed to read out a passage from Tsunami Girl for the listeners.
Yeah, I'll just set it up a little bit to explain this short section I'm going to read. So Yuki is really struggling with school. She's struggling with anxiety in particular, and she can't actually make it into school at the moment. So in desperation, her parents have decided to send her to Japan to stay with her beloved grandfather on the coast. And he's trying to think how he might help revive her, how he might help bring back the once confident Yuki he used to know. And she, when she was a small girl, used to draw manga. She used to invent superheroes and kind of invent stories for them and draw them continuously. So at this point, the grandfather has produced a box containing all the old drawings that Yuki used to do. Yuki watches as Grandpa flips the concertina pages of the book in front of her. The paper has yellowed a tiny bit, but the coloured pencil is still vibrant. So certain, so childish, it feels like someone else drew the images. But the weird thing is, she remembers doing every single one of them as soon as they pop into view. And on every page is at least one simple but sure-handed drawing of a boy with bright blue wavy hair, running on a shrine roof, diving down between clouds of fish to a sinking ship, gliding through tangled fragments of Japanese, misspelt English, and sound effects. Grandpa sits back, and instinctively Yuki turns the next page to reveal a mountainous wave, coloured in every shade of blue you could imagine. And riding barefoot on the wave's back, there he is again, the boy in traditional summer clothing, his bright hair standing straight up, his face more smile than anything else. "When you smile like that," Grandpa says quietly, "you could chase any shadow from any corner of any place, no matter what. Once upon a time, there was a boy, an underwater boy who could ride the waves on bare feet and loved to sing, and whose song controlled the waters of the world. He came from out of the sea, but loved the land and the people who lived on it, and had a huge heart and eyes that could see clearly. Who calmed the catfish who caused the earthquakes and rescued sailors in distress and dealt with any trouble that came along. Tsunamis, maybe." And Halfwave's song floated under the stars as he surfed the waves, and everything was fine, totally fine. Young Yuki dreamed him up from wherever our heroes come from, and he in turn made her. But in the end, the little hero slipped away into the water, forgotten in the usual mess of growing up, just as a wave breaks and merges back into the ocean again.
Julian Sedgwick, reading from Tsunami Girl, which has been shortlisted for this year's Yoto Carnegie Medal. And Julian, that really introduces us to one of the core themes of this book, which is about resilience. Yuki leaves the UK because she's finding it difficult and steps straight into a disaster zone. And she really has to be thrown back on her resilience, on her self-belief. And I'm guessing that's what you really want readers to take away from this book.
Yeah, I think this is where I feel with this book that a lot of elements of my life are kind of coming together. So my own childhood experience of really struggling, I mean, to the edge of coping at school. I've been a therapist for over 20 years now, and I watch people go through the most extraordinary things, you know, things you think they're never going to process. But across time, I see it's amazing where resilience and hope can come from. And then thirdly, the message the particular friends I've made in Fukushima always want to stress is that there is hope that you can find even in the darkest places, even if it's a little flicker. So poor old Yuki, in the book, I throw her into almost an unimaginable crisis, and yet it is going through that crisis that helps her to find a way to start to live again. But I didn't want it to be too neat a mechanism, because that's not true to life either. And, you know, with therapy clients, you see people make progress, slip back, make progress, slip back. So I hope all of that works. And it's funny, characters do come to life. And I'm very fond of Yuki now and watching her cope.
She's kind of written herself a narrative that traps her at the beginning of the book. And it is only really the disaster that breaks that narrative and allows her a way out.
Yeah, I thought that's really nice thought, because this is something I'm thinking about more and more, about how we tell stories that limit us quite often, how we tell stories that do trap us, as you say. And the truth is, often when in my therapy work, when a client hits crisis, you're obviously feeling really worried for them and really sad, but you also know this is the opportunity moment. This is when things start to shift sometimes. So again, without wanting to be too glib about it, it is often really diving into the crisis that is the way forward. And yes, I hope that's where things like the therapy experience and, you know, a few books into my writing career now are all starting to merge together.
And perhaps why you are bringing manga into your work, because it shows the power to imagine, for your characters to picture themselves in a different setting.
Absolutely. It's a really nice way of putting it. I think this is the thing. If we can imagine something, there is a possibility. And that imagining can come in many ways. And the manga element of the book became a way for Yuki to work with her imagination. And obviously it's, you know, I think in my own life, it was imagining possible selves that helped me to get out of the anxiety and depression that my own experience caused me. So yes, like Blake said, it all comes down to imagination, right?
Indeed. As we mentioned at the start of the interview, you were last shortlisted in 2020 with your brother Marcus. He's no stranger to being shortlisted for this prize. Is there a sense of friendly rivalry between the two of you?
I think, you know, sibling relationships are always complex, are they not? But I think when it comes to writing, and particularly these days, I think we really respect each other's ability. And yeah, he's been shortlisted a lot. Between us, we were just saying the other day, we just added up the total of our shortlistings. So as a sort of team effort rather than as a rivalry.
Well, many congratulations on being shortlisted again. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to talk about some of the books that have inspired you as a writer. But for now, Julian Sedgwick, thank you for coming onto the show.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Tsunami Girl is available in Braille from the RNIB library and in print and ebook wherever you buy your books. And since that interview, Julian has been in touch and confirmed that Tsunami Girl is about to be recorded as an audiobook. We, of course, will bring you news of when it enters the RNIB library. And Julian will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Manjeet Mann takes us on a journey across continents and cultural divides and reveals some universal truths. But first, here's Hannah Taus to take us over the Atlantic to small-town America.
Set in small towns across Alaska and the American West, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock has produced a set of short stories that sing. Following on from her debut novel, The Smell of Other People's Houses, which was also shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal back in 2017. Everyone Dies in a Small Town is a brilliant collection that covers a lot of ground in a relatively short book. Each story stands alone, but is linked by the introduction of a character in one story, no matter how brief or casually, who we meet in the next tale. Despite being set in the 1990s, the problems and dilemmas faced by these teenagers are timeless. The everyday issues of sibling rivalry, strained friendships and betrayal, they're interspersed with the more serious and challenging subjects of bereavement, sexual abuse and burgeoning sexual identity. But regardless of the subject matter, each one is treated with a sensitivity and depth that makes every story equally moving. Angry Starfish is the first of the vignettes and tells the story of Gina, who's having difficulty adapting to the death of her mother and her father's new girlfriend and young daughter, Poppy. Gina's resentment is compounded by seeing her father give some of her mother's belongings to the little girl to keep her warm when the two go out sledding. But the relationship between the potential siblings is obviously a work in progress. After all, Poppy's imaginary mermaid friend speaks to trauma within her own life, and indeed we learn that the little girl's best friend went missing before they moved to the wilds of Alaska. The result is a tale where you can feel your fingers freezing in the icy landscape and are touched by Poppy's innocent wisdom and Gina's ability to grow from the experience.
Gina pushed the metal snow shovel across the ice, carving a path that she and Poppy could then skate on. Well, if Poppy would quit whining and get her skates laced. Somehow Gina had gotten roped into taking her dad's girlfriend's kid to the pond. She'd only relented because it was minus 20 outside, and Poppy had looked horrified at the idea. Her dad's getting a new girlfriend had given Gina's anger a whole new lease on life. Until recently, she'd thought it had been waning, but mostly it just smoldered inside her ribcage. It was exhausting being herself, fighting so hard all the time. She had been almost ready to just give up and let it all go. Moving on was what her counselor called it. And Gina wondered if she meant they should pack up and leave town, start over somewhere that did not remind Gina so much of her mother. Instead, the girlfriend, Libby, had arrived with her cute little daughter and poof, it was as if someone had thrown kerosene on Gina's smoldering briquettes of anger. She could feel the flames leaping, the heat licking her sternum. On really cold days, it was almost nice. "Sure, I'll take Poppy over to the pond to skate," she heard herself say. "We could even hitch Alpaca up to the sled and have him pull us over." Alpaca was their oldest husky, her mother's favorite, and the trip would take twice as long with him. Gina smiled smugly to herself, thinking of her otter fur mittens that never let the cold get anywhere near her fingers. Poppy's, she'd noticed, were down and Gore-Tex, no comparison to animal skins.
Erin Tripp, narrating Everyone Dies Famous in a Small Town by Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Basketball Town is a story that highlights the perceived pressures of teenagers. Kelsey lives in a place where basketball is the be-all and end-all. If you can't play, then you support the team in any way you can. And those who have no interest are viewed as outsiders, square pegs trying to fit into round holes. While Kelsey is obsessed by basketball, desperate to make her referee father proud, her cousin Lillian has moved away, searching for freedom from the town's single-minded focus on the sport. Neither can understand the other's point of view, but separation gives them the space to reflect on their feelings. As an adult, what stood out for me is the unconditional love that Kelsey's parents have for her. As she begins to explore her true sentiments for basketball, whether she plays out of a sense of necessity, loyalty to her parents and town, or for the love of the game, it becomes apparent that her mum and dad are much more perceptive than she realises, and only wish her to be happy, even if it means sacrificing their own desires and ambitions. Meanwhile, Lillian, away from the oppressive atmosphere of Basketball Town, comes to love the game as an expression of companionship and fun.
Inside her car, Kelsey turns on the wipers and watches a thin layer of ash swish across her windshield like gray snow. This summer is a disaster, and not just because of the fire. She really misses her cousin Lillian, who has only sent 2 postcards and has not apologized for leaving without saying goodbye. Lil loves Alaska, says it's just like Montana, but bigger in every way. Bigger mountains, bigger skies, bigger belt buckles, as if that's possible. She doesn't know that fires have choked all the life out of the wide Montana sky. She's too busy writing poetry and plucking freezing cold children out of a glacier-fed lake. She hadn't even asked Kelsey to go with her when she applied to be a counselor at Camp Wildwood. But of course, they both knew it was impossible. No way could Kelsey miss 2 months of basketball. Still, Lillian could have asked. It was their inside joke that even weirdos like to be invited. Although normally the joke referred to Lillian, who had not inherited the basketball gene like almost everyone else in Laird. Lillian was not part of the inner circle that revolved around practices and away games and huge parades every year that celebrated the Laird Lynx and their many, many state titles. Parades on Main Street were so prevalent, they were boring, according to Lillian, punctuated by balloons and marching bands and the players riding in Cal Worthington's pink Cadillac, waving their state trophy year after year, while a sea of maroon and gold supporters lined the streets.
Erin Tripp does an outstanding job of narrating, entering the personality of each protagonist. Even when you don't necessarily like the characters, you at least understand them, and I found myself listening late into the night. Yes, some of the stories are heartbreakingly awful. A paedophilic priest, a missing child, a murderer. But it never moves into the grotesque or becomes lurid with explicit details. And some of the stories fill you with an unassailable joy, whether the tale has the traditional happy ending or not. The pleasure comes from the realisation that young adults can be resilient, change, and learn from their experiences. This book is indeed a worthy contender for the Yoto Carnegie Medal this year. Everyone Dies Famous in a Small Town by Bonnie Sue Hitchcock is available from the RNIB Library in both audio and braille, as is her previous book, The Smell of Other People's Houses.
Thanks, Hannah. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Julian Sedgwick to share the books of his life, Manjeet Mann was shortlisted for last year's Carnegie Medal for her outstanding debut novel, Run Rebel, and with all her success, is becoming quite a regular on Read On. We last heard from her in January, when her follow-up, The Crossing, won the Costa Children's Book Award. Manjeet, welcome back to Read On, and well, congratulations again on being shortlisted for another literary prize.
Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
We must stop meeting like this.
I know. Got to say, you are one of my favourite interviewers, though. You're brilliant. So.
Oh, thank you very much. You're one of my favourite interviewees. So I'm always glad when you get shortlisted. It's always a great excuse to get you back onto the show. Now, for anybody who didn't hear our interview when you won the Costa Children's Award, could you just tell us what The Crossing is about?
Yeah, sure. So The Crossing is about 2 teenagers from opposite worlds. You have Sammy from Eritrea and Natalie from Dover. And it's a story of hope and grief and the very real tragedies of the refugee crisis. So in Dover, you have Natalie, whose mum has just passed away, and her brother Ryan joins a far right group. But she finds solace in swimming and she decides to swim the channel for a charity that helps refugees. But similarly, Sammy's world is also falling apart because he's just lost his dad. His dad's been murdered in Eritrea, and he has to leave Eritrea to escape forced military conscription, which is a huge human rights issue in Eritrea that not many people know about. And he makes this perilous journey across Africa and into Europe, trying to get to the UK. But a twist of fate brings both of these characters together and gives them both hope in a world where they feel quite hopeless. And the story is told through the lens of both Natalie and Sammy. They're the narrators of their own story, and the novel flows back and forth between both voices.
And it's a novel in verse, and part of the way you weave together their two stories is you echo the last line or word of each of their two stories, where the other character picks up their own story in the next chapter.
Yeah, I do. It was an idea that came in from the very beginning. I always knew that that was what I was going to do, or how I was going to write the book, basically. And I just wanted to highlight that metaphor of how we're all connected, really, and all of our stories are connected. We're all part of the human race. There's more that connects us than divides us. And another way that I do that through the book is through the metaphor of stars and stardust as well. So, yeah, I just wanted to highlight that connection between humanity, really. And that's quite a big thing to say that all around. But that's kind of what I wanted to do.
This is, as you say, about building empathy, about showing that these two teenagers have far more in common than their different upbringings might otherwise suggest. As you say, they are both grieving and they both feel really hopeless in the face of overwhelming emotion and world situations that they cannot control. And this is something that's really very central to all the books on the shortlist for this year's Carnegie Medal. Do you think that children feel more alienated, more hopeless in the wake of the last 2 years and the pandemic?
Oh, wow. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I think the studies that are being done at the moment certainly show that, which is really very sad. I think when I was writing this, obviously, I started writing it at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, so just before everything shut down. And I was just writing it from a point of view of, I already felt that people feel very disconnected from what's happening around them. And so that's where I was coming at this story from that kind of feeling that people already feel that's happening really far away. That doesn't really affect us at all. Even when we were hearing about it, the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, January, February, we were still sort of thinking, oh, it's only in China. So there's always been that feeling of, oh, it's happening really far away. I mean, and then in the wake of the last 2 years, yeah, oh my gosh, I think that feeling of feeling hopeless. I think there was a study done recently, I can't tell you which one it was. It was just in the paper that I read about recently, that depression's really gone up amongst young people. Yeah, and it's because I think they were saying, because they feel so hopeless about the future and they feel so hopeless about what they can do about the big things that are happening in the world in terms of the climate crisis, I think is a big one that keeps coming up for them as well. So yeah, it's just really compounded on young people's mental health, definitely.
Yes, it does feel like wave upon wave coming in against their future. And yet the mantra that Sammy's mum has instilled in him, don't forget to love, don't forget your worth, don't give up hope, no matter how bad the things you see, just rings out throughout this book. It's a beautifully simple phrase. And I believe it's one that you actually heard from a refugee yourself.
Yes, so that was actually something that was said to me in an interview, and I just thought it was so profound and just so beautiful. And like you say, like just so simple, and most of the most profound and beautiful things usually are quite simple, aren't they? So I did ask for his permission. I was just like, please, can I use that in the book? It just says everything. Yeah, I just found it really healing when I heard it, and I hope that it's healing for people that might read it.
And I know that you work with refugees where you live down in Folkestone. This book also focuses on the reaction of some of the local white youths in Dover, where Natalie's end of the story is set. And there are some fairly right-wing anti-immigration views flowing through Ryan's friends. I know you're a stickler for your research. I take it that you sat down and talked to people who have those feelings.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I spoke to so many people over the 5 years that I kind of researched this book. So I sat down with a lot of refugees. I sat down with a lot of young people with those views, young men and women. It actually coincided with a theatre project that I was doing at the time. And it was actually a project about Brexit and what people thought about Brexit. And it just worked in synergy with the book, actually, in terms of the conversations that we were having in those rooms with young people. So that was pretty prickly and difficult. I didn't always feel very safe in the room, sort of like, oh, I'm the only brown face here. What do they think about me? But do you know what? The way I try and come at everything is from a place of empathy and understanding. Because I get this a lot. I get this question a lot in schools. I've been going to a lot of schools with this book. And I get the question, did you speak to people like Ryan? And oh my gosh, what was that like? Did you not just get really angry? And it's like, no, actually, if you want to make change, you have to come at it from a place of just understanding. Because a lot of the time, people just want to be heard. People just want to say their piece. They want to be understood. And once you allow that in any space, and it's a safe space, and we say you can say whatever it is that you want to say. I was not facilitating the sessions, thank goodness. I was just sort of listening in and, you know, being part of the discussion. But I had an amazing facilitator who knew how to, like, work those rooms. And we just listened. And you'd be surprised that when you just allow people to say what they want to say, you don't have to agree with it. It's really ugly and it's upsetting. But you can understand it. You can just try and understand it. And then everyone can just have an open discussion. And I will tell you this, 9 times out of 10, people kind of sort of were on their way to changing their views because they just want to be heard. But I think we're in a society at the moment which is very divisive. You think this, I think this, about so many things. Brexit was obviously the first thing that I personally feel that really divided the country. And now we've had more things on top of that over the last 2 years. We've got to be in either camp. No, you don't. No, you don't. Just listen. You don't always have to agree, but you just listen. And change comes with that. And we left most of those rooms shaking hands with everybody, which might seem a little bit like, oh, that's sort of like, oh, probably not realistic or whatever. But it is true. So in terms of writing the character of Ryan as well, I didn't want to write him as a villain. I wanted to write him as a character that people could understand, don't necessarily have to agree with. Hopefully nobody agrees with, but you understand it and you have empathy, because we can only change people's minds from a place of empathy.
And the ability to give testimony like that is exactly what is denied to Sammy and what has caused his father to be shot by the authorities in Eritrea. And you show that actually the willingness to allow testimony to be given is incredibly important. It can actually change people's lives. And I suppose that's what you're pushing at with this book. People need to be allowed to express their opinions, even if they are not palatable to those around them, as you say, just to clear the air and then hopefully to move on.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. Yeah, that's what I try and do with every piece of work that I make, whether that's something for TV or theatre or the books, definitely. Because even with the last book, Run Rebel, I try and give Dad a voice, you know, later on, so people can kind of understand, not agree with, obviously. But you have to allow that. And I think we're possibly, just at the moment, it feels like we're in a place in time where we're just not listening. That's how it feels. So when I'm going around schools, that's like the message that I try and put out there.
And I can hear the smile in your voice as you say that, because I know that what is most important for you is when your books do help people to see from a different point of view. And I know you have had some amazing feedback from teachers and readers alike with both your books, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Oh, which is just the best feedback of all. Trumps absolutely everything when you get that email. Yeah, so in terms of The Crossing, because I went round schools in Kent, and you was sometimes met with a bit of prickliness, should I say. But I remember getting an email from a teacher who said, oh, there was a couple of lads in my class who you could probably tell were not your biggest fans, but they did pick up the book and they've really changed their minds. And I just thought, whoa, that's worth a million awards. That's just amazing. So, yeah, and if I could just keep doing that, that's amazing. That's the power of art, isn't it, really?
Definitely. And there's a real sense of what we inherit from our parents isn't always 100% positive. Certainly in Sammy's case,
his mother's mantra is his bulwark throughout this book, having to try and live up to the example that his father set is both a bit of a blessing and a curse. It provides hope in the stars that he used to gaze at with his father, but also he never feels he'll measure up to his father. And likewise, Nat doesn't feel that she can measure up to her mother's wonderful example. And the book helps us see that if you only seek to measure up to your elders and betters, you will probably fall short. But if you approach issues on your own terms, you're more likely to make progress.
Yes, I remember us talking about this before as well, and I just thought, like, no one else has picked up on this. And it's, do you know what? I'm not even sure I picked up on it whilst I was writing it. But I just sort of think it's such a wonderful point. Yeah, and I think throughout the book, Natalie, perhaps more so than Sammy, I think, kind of finds her own way, doesn't she? It's something that I feel that, and then maybe you might disagree with this, Sammy does battle with throughout a little bit more. I wonder whether, I've been thinking about this a lot actually, whether it perhaps it comes from my own cultural background in a way, in terms of, especially in my family, it's all about living up to your parents' expectations. But maybe most children do actually feel that. And I think I might, as I'm going around to schools, pose that question during the Q&A. I just think it's really interesting. I think a lot of children do actually, or teenagers probably do feel that pressure of living up to their parents to a detrimental effect sometimes. So yeah, I haven't really got an answer to that, other than I totally agree with you, and it's a really great point, and I actually want to analyse it a little bit more.
Well, I'm sure there's another book on its way. I can't imagine that your pen has been still since The Crossing was published.
No, it hasn't. And funnily enough, I think it might be a bit of a subplot with the character of book four, but at the moment, in terms of living up to parental expectation, but in terms of book three, that's on its way to meeting a very important deadline in the next sort of 2 months. So I'm busy working, but also with The Crossing and the first book as well, they're both being adapted for stage, so I'm working on the stage adaptations of both of these books as well. So a lot of writing.
In the meantime, whilst we wait for the stage production, we can enjoy the wonderful audiobook versions of both your books, Run Rebel, obviously narrated by yourself, and Kimberly Capero and Ahmet Hamid, who do a fantastically authentic job of narrating The Crossing.
I should have taken more videos of her. I should have recorded every moment, caught every breath, savoured every laugh. I touched the screen, wanting to grab hold of her, to reach through my phone and pull her out. I wish she was still here, Dad. I know, love, I know. Dad's desperate to keep it together, but he's broken. We all are. We've kept our distance these past few months, keeping our sharp edges to ourselves. Getting too close could cause a puncture, and then we'll see it. The emptiness. The grief. It will leak out or pull us in. Either way, there'll be no escaping it.
Kimberly Capero narrating The Crossing, written by my guest, Manjeet Mann.
You, I know, went out of your way to make sure that you got narrators who came from the places their characters had originated from.
Yeah, that was really important. Especially with Sammy's character, because I think in terms of the casting, the first sort of like actors and like voice reels that I was getting, this is a problem when it comes to theatre and audio sometimes, is that when it is a voice from somewhere else in the world, casting people seem to go for this, oh, general foreign accent, may I say. So when it came to Sammy, I was just being given all of these voice reels and it was just this general African accent. And it's like, guys, over 50 countries on that continent, where people sound very different, and East African Eritrean is very particular. And so luckily I was working with my sensitivity reader, who's Eritrean, and also working with some of the young boys that I'd interviewed, and I just kept giving them voice samples. Is this right? Is this right? Is this right? Even though I knew sometimes like it wasn't. And there was even specific things about how certain words were pronounced. So yeah, in the end, we managed to find somebody who, I think he's actually Sudanese, but in terms of the Sudanese and the Eritrean accent, there's a lot of similarities. And then he just worked really hard to make sure that he was on it, which was great. And then in terms of Kimberly, she's from this part of the world as well, Kent, so that was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, it was a long search actually, and had I had not been more with it in terms of the accent, it would have been very different, possibly upset a lot of people.
Again, your background as a theatre director has really paid off with this. It is a beautiful, beguiling and very moving book, and thoroughly deserves its place on the shortlist for this year's Yoto Carnegie Medal. I hope that this time next year you will have made it three in a row with your next book, but no pressure.
No pressure, please.
Manjit, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you so much for coming back on to Read On, and many congratulations with your latest shortlisting for another literary prize.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
The Crossing, written by Manjit Mann, is available from the RNIB Library. Now it's back to Julian Sedgwick for the books of his life.
Julian, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
You know, I was having a little think about this, preparing for this section, and I often say, you know, I read a lot of fantasy. I was a huge Tolkien fan, and that probably my early writing was that. But I thought a more interesting answer would be to pick a non-fiction book, and that is Heinrich Harrer's 7 Years in Tibet, which is one of the books that really transformed my life. So when I was going through that early secondary school years, really struggling, it was a book I picked up in a secondhand bookshop and read this incredible account of Harrer's journey out of a prisoner of war camp in northern India into the then totally closed kingdom of Tibet, where he became personal tutor to the then Dalai Lama, who is still alive, is the current Dalai Lama. And it was almost a book beyond imagining, like reading about a world you couldn't have dreamt up. And for many years, that was my plan, was to try and travel to Tibet and become a monk there. So it sort of fired my imagination. It fired my interest in the Far East. And it's a book that I still have on my treasured bookshelf.
My plan was to seize the first opportunity to slip over the frontier again into Tibet. We were all of us convinced that the minor officials we had hitherto encountered were simply not competent to decide about our case. This time we had to approach some higher authority. To find what we wanted, we should have to go to Gartok, the capital of Western Tibet, which was the seat of the governor of the region. So we marched down the great, much-used trade road a few miles till we came to the first Indian village. This was Namgya. Here we could stay without arousing suspicion, as we had come from Tibet and not from the plains of India. We passed ourselves off as American soldiers, bought fresh supplies, and slept in the public rest house. Then we separated.
Eric Gillette, narrating 7 Years in Tibet by Heinrich Harrer, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, for this I was thinking about, you say rainy day, but I'm going to pick the summer book by Tove Jansson. What I love about that book is that it kind of speaks to young readers, old readers, everybody in between. It's about the relationship between a young girl and her grandmother and exploring their sort of interests, but also their fears about the world. You know, when you're at the beginning of your life and when you're at the end of your life, maybe you're closer to those big questions, you know, like why are we here and what happens afterwards and all that kind of stuff. And it's done with such beautiful description. I first read it sitting in a rowing boat moored to a dock on a Swedish lake. So it's kind of, I always remember that experience when I pick it up and reread it. And I think it's just incredibly wise and so beautifully written. So that's my cozy book.
Unfortunately, the summer book by Tove Jansson isn't available in audio, but here's a clip that we found on YouTube, and you can find the Braille version in the RNIB Library.
Sophia's grandmother had been a scout leader when she was young. And in fact, it was thanks to her that little girls were even allowed to be scouts in those days. The girls never forgot what good times they had had, and they often wrote to grandmother and reminded her of this or that incident, or quoted a verse of some song they used to sing around the campfire. It all seemed a little out of date to Grandmother now, and she thought that the old girls were being a bit sentimental. But she would think some friendly thoughts about them all the same. Then she'd think about how the scouting movement had grown too large and lost its personal touch, and then she'd forget the whole thing. Grandmother's children had never been scouts. No one had had the time somehow, and it never came up. One summer, Sophia's father bought a tent and put it up in the ravine so he could hide there if too many people came. The tent was so small that you had to crawl in on all fours, but inside there was enough room for two if they lay close together.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I'm going to pick a reread, actually, which is Quaidan by Lafcadio Hearn. And Lafcadio Hearn was an incredible man. He travelled to Japan in 1890, and he was one of the first Westerners to really do a sensitive job of collecting Japanese folk tales and ghost stories. And he actually took a Japanese name. He married a Japanese woman and took her surname. And it's one of those first great instances of a Westerner actually being sensitive and thoughtful and exploring Japanese culture. And the ghost stories still read incredibly well. I sometimes read bits of them when I do school visits. And I hope that's accessible for you.
Sadly, there's no audiobook version of Quaidan, Stories and Studies of Strange Things, by Lafcadio Hearn. But the RNIB Talking Books Library has recorded his collection of Japanese ghost stories, which is narrated by Elena Matsura.
The body was cold as ice. The heart had long ceased to beat. Yet there were no other signs of death. Nobody even spoke of burying the woman. She had died of grief and anger at having been divorced. It would have been useless to bury her, because the last undying wish of a dying person for vengeance can burst asunder any tomb and lift the heaviest graveyard stone. People who lived near the house in which she was lying fled from their homes. They knew that she was only waiting for the return of the man who had divorced her. At the time of her death, he was on a journey. When he came back and was told what had happened, terror seized him. "If I can find no help before dark," he thought to himself, "she will tear me to pieces." It was yet only the hour of the dragon, but he knew that he had no time to lose.
Julian Sedgwick, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
It's an absolute delight. Thanks really very much for having me and for those lovely questions. Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.